Hi, I'm Chris Berube. Today on Focus, we'll look at a story about abuse and scandal and censorship and art and provocation in rural Illinois. Last spring, Susan Toomey, who curates the Buchanan Center for the Arts in Monmouth, Illinois, put out a call for artists to enter a nationally juried exhibition called 64 Arts. Among the entry was a collection of vases by a California-based artist named Joe Pinkelman. Joe's vases were highly controversial because they contained images taken from gay pornography and dealt with the Catholic Church abuse scandal. Toomey struggled with whether or not to display the vases even before contest judge Eric Fischel chose them as the winner in several categories. Today on the show, we'll talk with Toomey, Fischel, and Lawrence Weschler, who recently published an article about the contest and the controversy surrounding the vases in the Believer magazine. That story coming up today on Focus here on WILL AM 580. That's coming up today after the news. You're listening to Focus on WILL AM 580. I'm Chris Berube. Susan Toomey runs a small art gallery in Monmouth, Illinois, called the Buchanan Center for the Arts. Last year, she decided to try something big and ambitious to bring attention to the gallery. She was going to put on a juried show with prizes called 64 Arts that would solicit contributions from all across America. She recruited Eric Fischel, the nationally renowned painter, to be the lead judge for the contest. Fischel isn't just a famous artist. He's also known for a project called America Now and Here, a program where he would bring valuable works of art to small towns across America. Toomey and Fischel wanted to select bold, complicated works of art for the show, but one of the pieces that Fischel picked created a lot of turmoil. The piece, a series of vases by the artist Joe Pinkelman, is about sexual abuse of young boys by members of the Catholic Church and features images taken from gay pornography. Not only did Fischel choose that piece for the show, he also gave it some awards. The resulting firestorm almost led to the Buchanan Center for the Arts losing its funding, and it raised many interesting questions about art, abuse, and censorship. Toomey and Fischel's story was featured in an article in the May issue of The Believer magazine written by Lawrence Weschler. The Buchanan Center for the Arts is holding another national contest this year, and their deadline is Friday, so I thought it would be an interesting time to revisit the controversy from last year. Susan Toomey, the curator, spoke to us from Tri-State Public Radio in Macomb, and Eric Fischel joined us on the line from his home in Long Island, New York. So, let's talk about how this story began. Eric, tell me a bit about how you started getting involved with artists outside of, I guess, the big cities in America.
Yeah, I created a project called America Now and Here, which was originally conceived as a kind of a traveling art experience with painters, sculptors, filmmakers, poets, music, etc., that would kind of try to reach outside of the sort of tight structure of the art world and go deep into the American fabric, trying to engage communities into conversations about their America. And at one point, my director, Dorothy Dunn, spoke to Susan about somehow connecting with her Buchanan Art Center. And then Susan reached out to me to do something, which in this case turned out to be to judge a national invitational, or actually an international invitational show that she was putting together. And I said I would be happy to do it.
So, Susan, you invited Eric to be a judge for this invitational, and you had a lot of ambition for this particular invitational, right?
We're in a rural community, and I'm very happy to say that for the last few years, we have really been expanding our programming and our ability to reach farther and farther out into our community. And I was hopeful that it was just kind of a lark, actually, on some levels, that I didn't really expect Mr. Fischel to agree, but he fortunately did. And I was thrilled to know that we were going to be able to put together with him a terrific exhibition, and it was outstanding.
So the submissions started coming in, and Eric, I guess, when did you notice Joe Pinkelman's work?
Joe's pieces were, you know, they stood out for so many reasons. You know, once identified it, it was easy to, you know, on some levels, easy to include them into the final mix, and at the same time, I knew what we were going to be up against. So
actually, could you describe what Joe Pinkelman's, what his work looked like?
Yeah, he submitted these white floral vases. They're white porcelain vases that had decals on them. And the decals were images. There was biblical text on it, and there were images of priests, and there was images of pornography. Really well executed, conceptually well executed works in combining both the terribly ugly and the decoratively beautiful thing that created a complicated experience for the viewer that was very confrontational at the same time. It was, you know, you're trying to deal with that sort of attraction to a beautiful vase at the same time you were repelled by its content. So.
Now, when you say there are images of pornography, these are actually works from pornography that he has reappropriated for the piece, like he's put them on as decals, essentially.
Yeah, it didn't, I mean, he you know, it didn't come with a text, so I didn't know, you know, exactly where he was getting them from, but they look like they were taken off of the internet.
So you're saying that, of course, this work had tremendous power for you, and it really did speak to you. Mm-hmm. Knowing kind of the context of what this invitational was going to be, did you have hesitation on selecting that particular work?
I did. I for several reasons. One of them was that it was such an aggressive thing. It immediately challenged my sense of, you know, moral responsibility. Should I censor it because of its content? Should I acknowledge it and, you know, allow it to find its place in the public domain? But I again was really torn. As someone who's also been a victim of censorship, I felt ultimately like I had to acknowledge this work and to pass it on to Susan.
So, Susan, you saw the work that was selected, including this piece by Joe Pinkelman.
Mm-hmm.
What was your immediate response? Did you think this is not something we should be showing, or how did you feel about it?
When I first saw the images, I, you know, just kind of took a deep breath and thought, you know, this is going to be a potential problem. But and I felt conflicted, actually, much in the same ways that Eric did. I don't really approve of censorship. It's not something I ever felt that I would actually ever have to do. In fact, I felt that I never would. And I felt a responsibility to this artist. I felt a responsibility to people who would and have been affected by what he was speaking about through his work. On the other hand, I knew that it was going to open up a potential can of worms that really could affect my community in a negative way. And so I actually kind of walked around it for a couple of days trying to decide what to do because I wasn't really sure. I mean, I was the only one that would ever know that they came in. But I couldn't live with myself if I hadn't done what I know is the right thing to do. And so I decided, you know, in the end to send them in, knowing full well that there was a strong possibility that the work would be chosen. But I felt compelled to do what I felt was the right thing.
So the work was chosen, and then when you were starting to put the actual, when you were actually starting to install everything, your father saw the piece, and then that's when it became complicated, right?
It did. I had kind of constructed this alcove area in our gallery that I was hoping to place the pieces there, because there were three of these vases selected, all three of the pieces that he had sent in. And I thought, you know, I have a lot of people coming into the gallery. My office is back, you know, a few feet from the gallery, and kids come in after school, and, you know, they bring their grandparents with them sometimes, and I didn't want someone to just kind of stumble across them or be confronted with them, you know, right out of the gate. And so I had set this place up, and I had left them in their boxes because I knew what they were, and I didn't want them out any sooner than they should be, in order for me to kind of be there to warn people, because I knew it was going to be a potential problem. And so we had come to the point where we were going to take them out and put them up, and I warned my father that they were graphic, and that's kind of how it started to break down in terms of the discussion and the relationship that we had been working towards in a lot of ways, personally and within the arts facility as well.
So your father, he sees the vases, he sees the piece, and immediately his reaction is that this is not art, and he becomes very perturbed by it. And then there's the proposition that he's suggesting that people who are funding the gallery might withdraw their funds if this is actually put on display.
Yes. I actually don't know if he disputed the fact that it was art. I think he was just really incredibly disturbed by the images. And my father did suggest, not immediately. I mean, we had a long discussion about pedophilia and about the priesthood and about the victims of these priests. And I suggested to my father that perhaps this artist had an experience that caused him to, you know, or compelled him to do this. And I wasn't the moral authority or the one to stop him from being able to tell his story. These conversations with my father took place over the course of several days.
So after this became apparent, it became apparent that this was going to be an issue that could actually imperil the funding of the gallery, you wrote your first letter to Eric Fischel, which is now reprinted in the Believer magazine, where essentially you say that you're concerned and you believe that for the good of everyone, it might be wise to withdraw this particular piece. Susan, do you have the letter with you?
I have the Believer with me.
Oh, terrific. Okay.
And don't cry.
I just actually had to wipe a tear away. I'm really sorry, but I brought Kleenexes. Oh, it's been buckets, Eric. You have no idea. Let's see. Dear Eric, I'm writing this letter to you today because, frankly, I don't quite know what else to do. I'm truly stuck between a rock and a hard place. When Joe Pinkelman sent in his works addressing pedophilia and the priesthood, I really struggle about what to do. I agree with the viewpoint of the artist 100%. I was, however, truly worried about the backlash that those works would bring to the Buchanan Center for the Arts and the conversations that we were hoping to build. I warned my board to prepare for the possible repercussions with these pieces. As you know, my father has been helping me install the show. On Thursday, I started expanding the spot where I hoped to place the priest pots, and I unwrapped one. My father went ashen. There's a long history between myself and my family and religion. I am the one that the Catholic Church didn't capture. And while this is a sidebar story for another day, it certainly was an issue that colored the discussion that followed. It actually wasn't a conversation, but a divisive, hurtful, and painful moment between my father and myself. My father left. I felt nauseous and spent the rest of the day either in tears or feeling the rise of anxiety. My father returned the next day. I could tell he really hadn't slept. I hadn't either. He told me that he'd been up all night thinking and had decided that if these items were to be displayed, it could ruin the BCA, and that I might indeed lose a majority of my funding. I learned a long time ago that civil discourse with such polar extremes is generally unproductive, just hitting my head against the brick wall. I also know that the graphic nature of these works won't start a conversation, it will end it. Dad told me that after much thinking, he decided that if the pieces were to be shown, he would pull his support from the BCA. On a personal level, that kills me. My father is in his 89th year. We've worked hard over the last few decades to put our differences aside and focus on the love we have instead. This morning, it was quite obvious that my father still hadn't slept, nor have I. He didn't really speak to me, but followed me out to my car to reiterate that not only could the funding go away, but that a poisonous board member that I've had to endure, another sidebar, again for another day, would like nothing better than to use this as a springboard to oust me from my position here. I have no doubt that he's correct in that assumption. When I came to the BCA in 2008, I found a small rural community art center nearly shuttered with a huge deficit. I've worked around the clock for 4 years to bring her back into the light and help to build community using the arts. We have an annual operating budget of approximately $125,000. That includes everything, administrative salaries for two people, teachers' salaries, lights, art supplies, programming expenses, children's theater productions, classes. We're the only institution like this for more than 60 miles in any given direction. The loss of funding from the Toomey Foundation would devastate the BCA, and others knowing that my father pulled funding would follow suit in a heartbeat. Although it may seem easy to think that my father is being unreasonable, I have to remember the time and generation it came from. A large portion of our membership and funders come from the same time and generation. I also have to bear in mind that the award monies are financed through the foundation, and one is named in honor of his deceased sister, Mary Jane. My Aunt Mary was a lovely woman, kind, very devout, and a true innocent. Even if I could convince him that the pieces should be displayed, any attachment to the memory of my Aunt Mary makes that impossible. So much good has come from having the center here. I know you saw the piece on the Lost Boys. That is one small example of the joyful moments and tender mercies brought about by using the arts as a catalyst for change. These moments have brought joy and hope and a renewed sense of vitality to our community. I can't tell you how happy people are knowing that this show is about to open, that you're coming here. The artists are thrilled, and the sense of pride that people feel is palpable. I have struggled to reconcile my feelings and what I suspect the outcome will be if I don't make a decision that will bother me personally, but would potentially cause the closing of the center. If I include these works in the exhibition, I would be burning down the library to save one book. On balance, I've decided to burn one book. I'm hoping that you will look at my situation with empathy and understanding. It's not a choice I hope to face, but in the end, I must. In truth, I don't know what the next step is, and I'm very dispirited right now. Susan.
So, Eric, what was your reaction when you saw that letter?
It's one of the most moving, profoundly conflicted, deeply felt, and beautifully articulated things that I read, and I got it. I read it. I was brought to tears by it. I was like, totally pulled into the conflict and the struggle that she was going through. And my reaction to it was, absolutely, take it out. This was not where we wanted to go with any of this stuff. This is, there'll be another time and place, et cetera, et cetera. And so please, don't hesitate on my account. I don't think... This getting to know Susan over the course of this, I think I can say that, she's an incredibly intelligent person who's not a polemicist. She's a moral person, but not somebody that is didactic or orthodox about about it, and certainly not political in that way. But feels, you know, she wants to do the right thing in the same way that I do, and I feel the same. I'm not a political person. I don't feel I have to make a political statement all the time with everything that I do or stand for. That, you know, the world is that complicated.
You're listening to Focus on WYLL. Coming up, we'll hear the end of the story with Eric Fischel and Susan Toomey. Also, we'll speak with Lawrence Weschler, who wrote about their situation for The Believer magazine. This is WYLL. This is Focus. I'm Chris Berube. This hour, we're joined by Susan Toomey and Eric Fischel. Susan is the curator of the Buchanan Center for the Arts in Monmouth, Illinois, and Eric is a painter. Last year, Eric led the jury for a show at the Buchanan Center where he chose a controversial piece of art that included images of sexual abuse and pornography. The artwork almost caused the gallery to lose its funding and made Toomey and Fischel question their own assumptions on art and censorship. That is such a remarkable letter because in it, essentially, you're wrestling with all of these very complicated feelings about issues that may seem absolute from the outside, issues like censorship and issues like artistic freedom and independence. I mean, Susan, how hard was it for you to write that?
Extremely difficult on a lot of levels. I mean, I had just left my mother and father's home after a very complicated morning. I was sitting in my office, as Eric would not be surprised to hear, crying my eyes out. And I was trying to write a letter to someone that I was getting to know and knew as a really kind and lovely soul. I mean, the communications that Eric and I had had, he struck me as a really nice person. But I also knew that, you know, he was a New York artist and had been censored. And here I was censoring something. And so that kind of frightened me. Too. But I kind of in my heart of hearts knew that the person that I had met had an empathetic soul, and that's what he proved.
So after, Eric, after you received this letter, the two of you devised a plan to tell Mr. Pinkelman that there would be kind of a compromise solution. So what was the compromise solution that you came up with?
Susan, can you answer that? Because I'm...
Well, I'm not. It wasn't really. I just wrote to Mr. Pinkelman and laid out again my thought process and what was going to happen, and that I didn't include his works in the exhibition. They were available if people knew they were there, and I had them in my office. And if people wanted to come in and see them, they could. And people did. People did come in and request to see them. And I am grateful to say that everyone who came in told me that I had made the right decision.
And also, what's interesting is there's also a letter from Joe Pinkelman that's included with The Believer, where he actually seems pretty much on your side. Like, mm-hmm. He's very understanding. I mean, were you at all surprised by that reaction from him?
I was actually surprised. The first letter that he wrote, I mean, he was more understanding than I could have hoped for, actually. And we had a couple of letters that went back and forth between us. They weren't all included in this piece, but over the course of our conversations, he was very gracious and understanding, and in fact, you know, said that he would have made the same decisions that I had.
Now, this is such a rich story, and it says so much about art in America. Eric, I wonder, you're an artist who does work in a transgressive way, and it's been mentioned that you have experienced censorship before. Did this change your perspective on censorship at all, or did this complicate your feelings about it?
You know, that's a really good question. One interesting aspect of this whole thing in Monmouth was that, you know, Joe Pinkelman's pieces were really intelligent. You know, and intelligent in terms of sort of putting together this total conflict between decorative and unseemly and tragic and stuff like that. Executed without a lot of emotional content to it, just something that becomes an iconic representation of something which to victims of pedophilia and stuff are obviously incredibly more complicated emotionally and psychologically in terms of self-image and whatnot. And when Susan wrote me her letter, which you just heard, it was so profoundly emotional and in its conflict that it brought me into a much deeper experience than the pieces that created it, right? And I was sitting there reading her letter thinking, wow, this is really what art is about right here. And it's something that I've always tried to aim for in my own work, which is to bring people into a very real experience that was complicated, that was, it wasn't just simply a two-dimensional sort of representation of taboos or whatnot, but was actually an emotional and psychological impacted moment that hopefully people would empathize with. So it wasn't about trying to push people away. It was about trying to draw people in. And so I identified with her letter as an artist trying to do the same thing.
You're listening to Focus on WILL. We're speaking with the curator Susan Toomey and the artist Eric Fischel about their grappling with a controversial work of art that was almost displayed at the Buchanan Center for the Arts in Monmouth, Illinois, last year. Their story was featured in the May issue of The Believer magazine. Mr. Pinkelman's work was not, I'm sure he wasn't intending to necessarily be divisive in and of itself. He was trying to express something and was trying to start an honest dialogue about this trauma. But what happened is that, you know, some people interpreted it as kind of having a brick thrown through their window as opposed to having a conversation started.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that such, I find it so interesting to sort of consider that line between what is provocative in a way that starts a healthy conversation and what's provocative in a way that just ends up causing destruction.
Yeah. You know, the context of art is very important to the experience of art. You know, there is a context in which Joe's work, I think, would be the most effective, which wasn't this context, in a way, because it wouldn't have prepared an audience ahead of time, for example. And I really believe that art should prepare an audience for what it's about to experience. I don't think it's fair to just, you know, show up, disrupt a life, et cetera, and leave.
Eric, I'm wondering, as an artist who is trying to bring art to these places in America that don't usually experience it, I mean, have you encountered other situations that are like this? Have you encountered other people who are going through some of these same struggles as Susan?
You know, the America Now and Here project, which has we've decided to disband because we couldn't kind of achieve the mobility that we had been looking for. The original vision of America Now and Here was to put all of this art onto these mobile museums that would travel into communities as small as something like Monmouth, as well as into inner cities and universities and military bases and stuff like that, you know, begin to connect people to a larger community or sense of shared interest. But we found it hard to really get the funding to do that. And this, the way we did it in Monmouth, actually is a great model for sort of reaching into a community, for sharing and exposing. For me, it was a huge exposure to go from the more familiar art world that I travel in, which is international, it's big cities, you know, museums, et cetera, to move into the small town, the rural community, and immediately feel both, you know, the passions and the complexities of living in a place like Monmouth. It actually, on some levels, was the realized ideal for the America Now and Here vision. At the same time, I have to say, traveling around the country to, you know, the regional centers like Chicago and Kansas City and Seattle and Los Angeles and Dallas and Houston, places like that, looking to, you know, get funding from these, you know, significant art centers to do this thing, I found a lack of imagination, actually, that it was very hard for people to sort of think outside of their immediate community. And their communities were very different. It was interesting for me. You know, for example, in Seattle, the people I talked to and the way they engaged America Now and Here was based on a kind of entrepreneurial spirit, which is something that is like encoded in the whole sort of high tech and kind of entrepreneurial culture that's in Seattle. In Los Angeles, the way they interpreted it was as entertainment. They saw this as a spectacle, you know. In Chicago, they saw it as social good and social responsibility. And in Kansas City, they saw it as patriotic. And so every place I went had a very particular way of interpreting what their America was. But at the same time, had lost a sense of connecting that far outside of what their experience and belief in what America was. And so it's hard to sort of put a whole sort of larger international or national program together about it. The other thing I found was that within these sort of regional centers, there was a lot of sort of trepidation and suspicion about the so-called, you know, New York artists or the fancy artists or the, you know, whatever it was that would be trying to come into their community and tell them what America was about, you know, which of course wasn't our intention, and that was immediately broken down when they saw how we engaged their local art community and how we it became a conversation rather than a demonstration and whatnot. But the initial thing was one of suspicion, and I found that a revelation as well.
Well, Eric Fischel and Susan Toomey, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate you taking the time, and the piece raises so many interesting questions. I found it totally gripping. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chris.
Eric Fischel's new memoir, Bad Boy, is available in bookstores now. Susan Toomey is the curator of the Buchanan Center for the Arts in Monmouth, Illinois. The artwork we've been talking about was almost featured in a juried show at the Buchanan Center last summer called 64 Arts. They are doing another iteration of 64 Arts later this year. The deadline for submissions is this Friday. Coming up, we'll talk more about this story with Lawrence Weschler, the man who wrote it up in the May issue of The Believer magazine. You're listening to Focus on WILL. This hour, we've been talking about a controversial artwork that raised questions about censorship and the nature of provocative art and abuse at a small gallery in Monmouth, Illinois last year. Lawrence Weschler wrote about the controversy for The Believer magazine. Weschler is one of the best-regarded literary journalists working today. He was a staff writer for The New Yorker for over 20 years and is now the director of the New York Institute for the Humanities at NYU. He joined us by phone from Manhattan. So what drew you to this particular story?
In this particular case, I was working in my capacity as the artistic director emeritus at the Chicago Humanities Festival. And we had decided to bring Eric Fischel to the festival, and I went out to his place in Sag Harbor to talk to him about what we could do, and he was just kind of stunned. He just handed me this letter. He said, "Look at this letter I just got." and he began telling the story of which you've now heard. So as we were talking, it just seemed to me that actually this would be in itself, in addition to talking about Fischel's own work, but this would be a very interesting thing to talk about. Fischel's work, as you know, is itself was at the time and is legendarily transgressive and unsettling, and he has all sorts of imagery. Was quite intentionally meant to get under your skin. And as a result of that, I mean, I think most people felt that, you know, the kind of Yahoo censorship of this work was unjustified, and there were all sorts of battles about his work and other people's work along those lines. And yet here was a case that really seemed to unsettle the unsettlers.
It's so interesting that you say the original letter seems so articulate. I mean, it does seem like someone who is wrestling with basically two absolute values, the absolute value of being a good member of her community and also the absolute value of being someone who believes in freedom of expression.
I think that's true. And also the third element is, as she puts it so eloquently, are we going to save the book at the expense of burning down the library? You know, I mean, it's not only a good member of her community, also being a good member of her family. And, so, you know, she threatened to blow up the family and to blow up the art center, which she had devoted her life to. And you know, for what? It was, I think one of the things that was most remarkable in the exchange was that the artist himself was understanding of the situation.
I do wonder why you called the piece Here in America.
Eric Fischel's whole project was called America Here and Now, and so I was just playing off of that. But I mean, it is an ongoing thing. I mean, here in New York City, we have the, to my mind, far more preposterous business about whether or not one could put the Muslim Cultural Center, the Islamic Cultural Center, a few blocks from Ground Zero. Nobody seemed to mind that there were all kinds of porno shops and things like that a few blocks from Ground Zero, but suddenly the notion of this cultural center, which was precisely engaged in trying to foster dialogue and so forth, was just absolutely impossible and so forth. And that, it seemed to me, now that I'm talking to you about it, I realize what the difference is, that was completely a manufactured, artificially fanned, you know, I guess I'd call it Fox News-generated controversy, that kind of thing. I mean, it was just, it was demagogued ridiculously. Whereas this was different. This was a local community, a family, which was suddenly faced with an authentic crisis, it seemed to me, a crisis of sensibility. So, I mean, that's an example of how I distinguish between those two. It's striking, for example, I come originally from L.A., and L.A. used to have one of these firestorms every 2 years. I mean, this was a way of politicians of a certain stripe getting their authority. This is back in the 60s and 70s. There was always, you know, trying to protect the children from the horrors of this whatever thing it was.
It's interesting. When I was reading the piece, I was thinking about the case about the National Endowment for the Arts in the 1980s when they were trying to, well, they were intending to grant money to Robert Mapplethorpe and a number of performance artists like Holly Hughes, and it became a controversy by which there was an argument that one should actually defund the National Endowment for the Arts because they were sponsoring what they were. So it almost seems like this is kind of an eternal American crisis.
Oh, it's absolutely. I mean, here in America, here and ever in America, this puritanical strain that runs through things. I mean, it is one of the sadnesses because most other countries have wonderful support for the arts. I mean, the Canadian Film Board, things like that. You know, the national film boards, the national artistic boards of almost all countries, except the United States. The United States is quite an outlier in this kind of thing. I mean, the notion that absolutely everybody in the country gets to have a veto on absolutely every artistic grant. I mean, looking back, for example, at Mapplethorpe and so forth, you know, the notion that the reason you couldn't support Mapplethorpe, who at that moment was a peer-reviewed artist, if you remember, the National Endowment would give out grants based on, they had long groups of artists who helped review these things and felt this particular person was worthy of one. You know, the notion that any individual minister or something could stand up and say, well, that's my tax money, I won't stand for it going to that. I mean, there's all kinds of things that I can't stand my tax money going for, but I don't go trying to burn down the whole building because of it. But in the United States, that happened, and you effectively have wiped out a whole cultural resource. I guess parenthetically that I might have felt different about this if this were appeared at the Smithsonian as opposed to a small little art center in a small town that was supported by the local town. The people. Another way of putting this is it often seems to be the people who go after these sorts of these things on these big, great, big public battles are really using it as a marker for something altogether different, and it's basically a power struggle between different groups that feel they can gin up their constituencies with getting them all hot and bothered by things. And that, once again, seems somewhat different to me in this particular situation. You know, another way of, I'll give you just another example, which just seems completely different, but it's interesting. Richard Serra, the great American sculptor and installation artist, who deals in huge, huge walls of steel in often incredibly interesting ways, had at one point put right across the middle of Foley Square, which was this big, highly a square in the middle of Manhattan, which had all kinds of people crossing it at all kinds of different angles to get from one place to another. And he put this very, very imposing tilted arc, as it was called. It was a wall that just completely bisected the plaza, and in a very beautiful, interesting way. And you know, it had all kinds of interesting architectural features and so forth. But it just completely disrupted that neighborhood. People who had ordinarily been able to cross, you know, had to go all the way around it and so forth. And at one level, Sarah was kind of making a point about how, you know, structures impinge on our lives and, you know, the way in which we actually, you know, take things for granted and so forth, which is all fine. But at a certain point, the community rose up in anger about it and said, well, fine, you've made your point. We don't like the thing. You've made, you know, let it. And he at that point became, oh, my, you know, art is eternal. You can't attack an artist. You know, this is a horrible crime. This is like taking down the Sistine Chapel or something. And that just seemed to me to be a ridiculous position on his part. I mean, you know, it seems to me that if you're going to do a transgressive act and you get pushback, that indicates to some degree the cultural community is working, that you're having an interesting dialogue and so forth. And if at the end of the day the piece stays up for 3 months and then is removed, it doesn't mean that the Sistine Chapel has been torn down. It means that you've gotten the response you were trying to get, and it's a dialogue. If in this case you do incredibly transgressive images about an absolutely appalling scandal, and it gets pushback of a certain kind, and yet has the effect of making the scandal be talked about more, it's worked. I guess I just favor a kind of more dynamic and dialogical kind of attitude toward what art is.
It's interesting because it's hard to know when a work of especially transgressive art is going to start a conversation and when it is going to feel like a brick through a window, like when it is going to feel like something that ends a conversation.
Yeah. And that in turn is also an issue that is a curatorial issue. It's a matter of presentation. Another way of putting this is this, the artist is not the great French philosopher said, Diderot once said that the artist is merely the first witness of the completed work. And in that sense has no more, higher standing than anybody else. And then there'll be other witnesses and other responses and so forth. And that begins to be the terrain of the curator. And it seems to me that one wants to urge as much openness as possible on all sides. But that's a two-way street. If you throw a brick through a glass wall and you get a hugely, excited response, and then you say, but the way the charge of the glass or on the floor is so incredibly, eternally beautiful. You know, I mean, that's okay, that's true, but it's also true that you've thrown a glass, pricked through a glass wall, and people are pissed off. And that's also very beautiful.
You're listening to Focus on WILL AM 580. I'm speaking with Lawrence Weschler, the director of the New York Institute for the Humanities at NYU. His piece, Here in America, is in the May issue of The Believer magazine. You wrote a book called A Miracle Universe, Settling Accounts with Torturers, where you sort of probed a little bit Uruguay and Bosnia and places where these cultures were essentially these cultures were essentially divided by the fact that there had been regimes that had been employing torture or were employing certain tactics that were deplorable, and that was kind of what was cutting that culture in half, so to speak. And I wonder if that has given you any kind of perspective on, like, the American cultural wars coming back and, you know, seeing that you've been in these places where essentially the culture is divided by death and murder and the deprivation of basic human rights. Does it make America's culture wars seem at all kind of puny in a way?
Several things you could say. First of all, alas, America was very much involved in the torture of those different countries. But no, there are issues in different countries. I mean, in those places, they were democratizing, quote unquote. They were going from regimes of torturers and so forth to democratic regimes. They were trying to figure out what to do with the prior torturers and so forth. On a significant level, the fact that terrible, terrible, terrible economic crimes have taken place in the last 5 or 6 years, and that nobody is being held to account, you know, is similar. And we walk around with these masters of the universe as if they get to walk around as if nothing's happened, and we let them. And so those sorts of issues of settling accounts remain. And then looking forward, you know, I mean, you think torture is bad. Wait till you see what the effects of global warming are going to be. You know, over and over again, there's a tendency not to face things or to demonize those who suggest that it's important that things be faced. And I think it's better to ventilate issues and to let them out and to have as great openness as possible. And oddly enough, coming back to this situation in Monmouth, I think that's what they did. They found a way, and it was a very creative way, of simultaneously acknowledging the sensitivities of certain people in the community and so forth, but at the same time, not just putting it under the rug, but keeping the subject matter at least open. It wasn't that important that you actually see those particular vases. I mean, it was rather that what was actually on the vases is not going to be nearly as bad as any kind of fantasies you can develop for yourself, having thought of them. But it was important that the subject that they were referring to be addressed, and it seems to be that it, in a rather creative way, was.
That's Lawrence Weschler. He's the director of the New York Institute for the Humanities at NYU. His books include Mr. Wilson's Cabinet of Wonders and The Uncanny Valley, and his piece in the May issue of The Believer magazine looks at the curator and an artist grappling with a controversial work of art in a rural gallery in Monmouth, Illinois. It's a totally fascinating read, and I recommend checking it out. Lawrence Weschler joined us on the phone from Manhattan. Thanks for listening. You can find past episodes of Focus online at will.illinois.edu. Focus is produced by Lindsay Moon, technical direction by Jason Croft. Special thanks today to Tri-State Public Radio in Macomb for recording Susan Toomey's half of our conversation. Join us again tomorrow at 10 o'clock on Focus on WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana. I'm Chris Berube. Thank you.